From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Of all the cases to explore a new challenge to press freedom, why did it have to be Hulk Hogan's sex tape? You know the story. The online tabloid Gawker posted the sex tape and was bankrupted in a lawsuit funded by the venture capitalist Peter Thiel. The filmmaker Brian Knappenberger knows, as test cases go, this one is pretty sleazy, but in his film, he's asking people to set aside the details and consider the implications of a thin-skinned billionaire willing to spend whatever it takes to silence a critic. We're talking to Knappenberger, whose documentary examines what he sees as a new threat to democracy, a media struggling to survive financially up against the richest people in the world. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So, be honest. At least some of you were glad to see the online tabloid site Gawker lose its case against Hulk Hogan for posting his sex tape. It probably seems satisfying to see a crass rumor monger get its comeuppance. And it really did. The suit bankrupted Gawker. They're pretty much gone now. But Brian Knappenberger's documentary points out, just because the case seems tawdry, and just because you may not approve of sites like Gawker, doesn't mean this isn't an incredibly important story. In fact, Leslie Savon of The Nation magazine tells Knappenberger that this is one of the most important First Amendment cases in American history. In fact, she says it's a threat to democracy. Basically, the film examines the implications of a thin-skinned billionaire being willing to spend whatever it takes to silence a critic. And it's not just this case. It turns out there are plenty of thin-skinned billionaires. Knappenberger's film is called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. It premiered at Sundance this year. That's when we spoke with Knappenberger. It's been now released for streaming on Netflix, so we're taking the opportunity to rebroadcast this conversation. Knappenberger is interested in technology, and he once said that we are in a moment where the internet and civil liberties are grinding together like tectonic plates.
You know, I think we're in a pretty extraordinary moment right now in which technology is changing so dramatically. I mean, pretty much every part of our lives is changing. The way we communicate, the way we share, you know, personal information, our own personal details, the security of all of that information. This is a big shift in the way humans are living. And I think that, you know, I think what I was getting at with that is that, you know, there are some things that we've decided are important, you know, free press, civil liberties, and that it's important that we that those things make it into this new world as things shift and change. I do think the tectonic plates are shifting, and I'm not sure we know how it's going to turn out yet.
But then you come upon this tawdry case, plays out in Florida, involves a wrestler, it involves a sex tape.
Yeah.
When did it occur to you that that was the case study to kind of illustrate this?
Yeah, it was interesting because I was actually interested in maybe making a film about Peter Thiel before the case, but I was so captivated by this case as it was kind of going through its twists and turns. This case between that was playing out in this Florida courtroom between Gawker Media and you know, this snarky website that a lot of people love and a lot of people truly hated. Hulk Hogan, a kind of American hero from the 80s, one of the, you know, biggest professional wrestlers of all time. It was interesting, and it was both salacious and highly principled at the same time. Yeah. And you never quite knew when you were watching when it would be either. And so I really felt like there was some very big First Amendment, free speech, free press, but also privacy issues underfoot. Right.
Yeah, they conflict, don't they?
Yeah.
Let me ask you, set up the kind of the landscape here, mm-hmm. because this is something you do early on. In fact, David Folkenflik of NPR, the media reporter for them, really does lay out this context. In fact, let me play this moment from the film.
There were so many things brought into play here and so many things at stake. You have questions of where lines are drawn for privacy in an age of immediate broadcasting. You have the question of who gets to set the taste for the country, what's appropriate. You have the question of to what degree is sex a matter of public concern when it occurs in private domain. There's the question of what an independent publisher can do without the backing of some sort of wealthy billionaire.
Morning, Mr. Bland.
Morning, Gus.
How you doing?
All is well,
man. Anything you want to say to your fans?
Yeah, man, I'm getting ready. I'm training for another title shot. Yeah, I'm getting in good shape. Belly's gone. Arms are jacked up. Yeah, I'm just looking for another giant slam.
So you have all these different dynamics sort of colliding in this courtroom in Florida. And you knew from the day it started that it was going to be an important one, but also a fascinating one. Big stories where big issues are at stake don't often resolve into perfectly neat morality tales, right?
The questions couldn't be bigger.
Yeah.
What is truth? What is false? What is reality? And especially in this new landscape.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you can't separate this case from this contentious election political cycle that was happening in the background. And, you know, it also takes place in Florida, very important political state politically. So I think, yeah, the way that this was playing out and – you know, it's not hyperbole to say like part of this was what is truth, what is real. Yeah. And that was playing out in this courtroom. But at the same time, we're seeing this election in which many people are asking the same thing. What is real?
Yeah.
Fake news stories and all sorts of things. So it was right from the beginning deeply and sort of entwined in this case. And this, of course, is before we realize that Peter Thiel was involved at all.
Yeah.
So we'll
work our way to that point because yeah. It's such an interesting moment when that is revealed. But we should probably say that attacking the media, becoming an element of this culture war, yeah. is an undercurrent also in this film.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, it's not unusual for politicians or powerful people to hate the media, but it's kind of the way it is. It's the way it's supposed to be,
yeah.
right? We're supposed to question power. That's the whole point. That discussion is sparked in a very, very vibrant way, I think, in this case.
Let's talk about Nick Denton because he's an interesting character. And one of the things I think you accomplish in the film is put a kind of nuanced spin mm-hmm. on his persona. He comes across to some or has because he owned this online tabloid, kind of a crass guy. Mm-hmm. But you reveal him, I think, as something else or something certainly more complicated. Talk about Nick Denton, if you would.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. I mean, I think when he talks about Gawker and what they wanted to accomplish with Gawker right from the beginning, he talks about, doing things, writing stories without favor, and not caring if somebody was, for instance, an advertiser for Gawker, just drawing a hard line that this is about stories. Now, obviously, Gawker has its detractors. Its detractors are many.
Yeah.
And there are many times, I think, that people thought that they crossed the line. And there are, I think, maybe a handful of times in which they actually did cross the line. But
sure.
they also, I think people reacted to Gawker in a way, at the tone of Gawker. They like to be hated. You know, this wasn't by accident. They liked to thumb their nose at powerful people. They liked to look at celebrities and say, what makes you better than us? And I think, Denton, when you start to kind of peel away the layers, I think there is something pretty interesting going on. They were never afraid to offend or insult. And you know what? Yeah, there's a place for that in our media ecosystem.
Yeah. Here's Nick Denton from the film.
I came from a traditional British newspaper journalism background. Seeing the first blogs, the barrier between the thought, the idea, and the page, and potentially to millions of readers, the barriers had all come down. It was a complete revolution.
You know, we launched Gizmodo, a tech site, and then Gawker.com, which became our flagship news site. My idea was a very basic one. What if you actually were to take the stories that don't get published, that the stories that journalists exchange amongst themselves, the kind of the behind-the-scenes look at what's really going on? Everybody knows that what usually appears, certainly in the establishment media, bears very little resemblance to what's really going on.
So on one hand, there's this kind of principle at stake, transparency. Let's talk about something. But then when you see the result of it, some of these stories are pretty distasteful, put it that way.
Yeah.
So he's a complicated figure, and Gawker is a complicated part of the story.
No question. And I think that that may hit on one of the reasons why I was so compelled by this. It's not a clean, easy story. You know, I really think if it was, I'd be less inclined and less compelled by it. They are on the edge. There's no question. There's a little bit of a hint of People versus Larry Flint in this too. That sense of where should the lines be drawn, and in a active, healthy democracy, we should have those lines allow for quite a broad range of speech, including, by the way, speech we just don't like.
Right. Let's talk about a fascinating element of this story, and that is the persona of Hulk Hogan. That's obviously not his name. It's Terry Bollea.
Yeah.
And there's this element in the film and in the story that as it plays out in the courtroom, the distinction between the two, the man and the character.
Right,
would you say something about that?
The argument that they made, ultimately, one of the arguments was that Hulk Hogan is a very public figure. Everybody knows that. And that there's a distinction between that public figure and his private self, right, Terry Bollea, and that this is a different person in private than he is in public. And I think that's a realistic kind of line to be drawn. But he even said on the stand that, look, when I leave my home, I'm Hulk Hogan. When I walk out the front door, I'm Hulk Hogan. The mailman, when he sees me, doesn't say, hey, Terry. He says, hey, Hulk. So, it starts out as an interesting distinction that becomes even more kind of bizarre and compelling when you start to think about, well, what does that mean? What is the nature of celebrity? What is this character? Is that really not him?
Yeah.
And you start to kind of peel away these layers of this. He talked, for instance, openly about his sex life on radio multiple times.
It's part of the persona.
And it's part of the persona. That's part of why Gawker said this was news.
Yeah.
And it got incredibly weird when, I don't know what you can say on the air here, but he said it became down to the size of his penis.
Yeah.
When he said, he talked about Hulk Hogan having a 10-inch penis and Terry Bollea, well, not so much. So the distinction, which is actually a pretty deep and sophisticated kind of discussion between what is a character in American society, commercial society, what is private, came down in some ways to the length of Hulk Hogan's penis.
It's such a strange part of the film, and I'm wondering what you're expecting in terms of a reaction, because here it is, a conversation about what could potentially be a threat to democracy.
Yeah.
And then you have this weird thing, and this question about the size of Hulk Hogan's penis, or Terry Bollea's penis, playing out on the stand in the courtroom.
It's right.
It's kind of funny.
It's kind of funny. It is, and it's salacious, and I think it shocked a lot of people that were sitting there in the courtroom and watching this. And you know, it's bizarre, but it's also kind of a big issue. And I think in the film we actually take it seriously.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
You know, we actually look at that. We actually take that as a serious argument. You know, what is a character?
Right.
You know, what license do we give? I mean, after all, Donald Trump was a TV character created by a reality TV show. And has often, when he said something that was egregious, particularly about women, has said, well, no, that's not what he really thinks. That was just him on a television show. So where does that leave people who are trying to figure out the truth?
Yeah.
You know, are we
– what do we do with
that?
Are
they allowed to lie under the guise of a character?
Well, that's what Nick Denton says in the film. Yeah. He says if we have to discount what they say because they were speaking as a character – how are we supposed to cover you? How are we supposed to deal with any of this?
Don't we ultimately own our own words and our own beliefs? and the way we present ourselves. I mean, it is a very murky territory, but I also think it's very much a product of television and commercials and advertising and all that.
Let's talk about – this sounds strange to ask this question like this. Let's talk about the sex tape. But we do have to talk about how it emerges because – it was just this kind of tawdry thing. It happens when there were a lot of sex tapes being peddled at the time. Mm. And I think what's really interesting is Gawker posts it and doesn't really think much of it. I mean, Hulk Hogan had sort of gone past his prime. It wasn't Kim Kardashian after all. They weren't really sure it really mattered that much, but they figured he was fair game. Let's go for it, I guess.
My impression is they took it pretty seriously.
Sure, sure. But what is it that John Cook says? He says, we weren't sure anybody even really cared that much.
Yeah. Yeah, he says that compared to some of his other the long list of Gawker stories that have caused outrage.
Yeah. And there's a long
probably
list.
Yeah. And there is a long list that this one probably didn't rank very high, at least when they first posted it. So I think that's an interesting perspective. There wasn't a big outcry that this was – inappropriate at the time. Does that mean that Terry Bollea, Mr. Bollea, didn't have a legitimate concern that this was a privacy violation? Of course not. You know, that is still legitimate.
Yeah. And this case is made by his attorney, David Houston.
Yeah.
Let me play this because he makes what I think is kind of a principal case that this is not for the good of anyone.
Yeah.
Our request of Gawker was quite simple. Take it down. We walk away. That was it. We didn't ask for anything. We didn't demand anything, save and accept. In the name of decency, if nothing else, take it down. We walk away. It was not a situation that needed to be publicized for the good of the American people or, for that matter, the world community. Quite to the contrary. It was salacious. It was ugly and mean-spirited.
But so what?
Yeah. First of all, I'm very glad to have David Houston in our film. He's, I think, a very strong voice for the Hulk Hogan's case.
He really is.
And I think he makes it really well in the case. And I think a lot of people will understand Terry Bollea's concerns when they listen to the way that he's made this. And they're a lot of more legitimate. I mean, look, it's a sex tape. It's a tape of the guy having sex. I mean, if there's a line, maybe that's where it is.
Yeah.
But
isn't that the question in part? Like when you're talking about the First Amendment, when you're talking about the free press, who's going to say what that line is?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like that really – the film really gets at that.
Yeah.
I know you don't think – I know you find this distasteful, but should – you censor it.
Yeah.
That's not really how it works.
Yeah.
You shouldn't.
And that becomes, I think, really clear when the verdict comes down.
Yeah.
Because there is a moment in this film, I think, when audiences will – I mean, I really hope, and as a filmmaker, I really hope we get Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea side of this correctly and accurately. And I do think that audiences will – have a lot of sympathy for this person on the stand as he describes, you know, being betrayed by his best friend and just what it meant to him to actually see this posted. But I think that when you get to the verdict, things start to shift and change in ways that become very dramatic and call new concerns into question.
Before we get to the verdict, I do want to say a few things about how this plays out. How important is it that this story plays out, a story about the Constitution, the First Amendment, that it plays out in a state court, not in the federal court?
Well, I can tell you what we know about that. There's basically it got bounced from federal court a couple of times. It was I think twice, if I'm not mistaken, this was considered protected First Amendment activity. It wasn't even heard. It was bounced out. So. That's important. I think I think one of the really key parts of this and especially the outcome was that it landed in Florida. It landed in Hulk Hogan's hometown community in front of a jury trial. So, you know, this is a big part, I think, of why we find ourselves where we are.
Gives us a chance to hear Floyd Abrams too.
Yeah.
Because he comments on this. Let's play. And he's a very important First Amendment lawyer. He's featured throughout the film.
Pentagon Papers.
Pentagon, exactly. Yeah. Here he is from the film.
The reason to save Gawker is not because Gawker was worth saving. The reason to save it is that we don't pick and choose what sort of publications are permissible, because once we do, it empowers the government to limit speech in a way that ought to be impermissible. Even the most disagreeable speech is, as a general matter at least, fully protected by the First Amendment.
But then it's playing out in this state court, and it's say something if you would about Judge Pamela Campbell, because this comes up too, the role that she plays in the case.
Yeah, so Judge Pamela Campbell was, interestingly, she was the lawyer for the parents of Terri Schiavo. And people remember that was a big part of a news cycle in the 90s where she was in vegetative state and the boyfriend wanted to pull life support and the parents didn't. At the time, lawyer Pamela Campbell represented the parents.
Right.
And it became, a nationwide political story in which, conservatives and liberals were taking sides in a very, very big way. And so it's interesting that's who's judging this case. So she is appointed to that judgeship by Governor Jeb Bush at the time.
And she makes these comments, I guess, before the trial about her concerns about the state of journalism.
Yeah, people, that raised some eyebrows, actually, that she might be sort of tipping her hand a little bit.
Brian Knappenberger, his film is called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. It premiered at Sundance this year. It's just been released for streaming on Netflix. You can go to our website for links to get more information. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a film that explores the responsibilities and challenges of the First Amendment and the free press in this confusing part of the information age. Director Brian Knappenberger's film uses as a case study the trial over Hulk Hogan's sex tape. The film has now been released for streaming on Netflix. We're rebroadcasting our conversation with Knappenberger. We spoke with him at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Okay, the verdict comes down, and say something about it. I mean, initially it was hundreds of – well, not hundreds of millions of dollars, $140 million total.
That's right.
Is where it starts. Say something about that, because that seemed unprecedented.
I think it is. I mean, it's an enormous verdict, $140 million for this. It's huge. It's enormous. I mean, it's many, many multiples of a standard wrongful death lawsuit. It was shocking. It made huge news. It was so decisively in favor of Mr. Bollea. And even the jury was warned not to bankrupt Gawker.
Yeah.
In fact, there are protections about this. So, but that's what happens anyways. A part of it was that they were forced to put up $50 million right away. So they were forced almost immediately into bankruptcy. And then they had to work out how to sell the company and what to do from there. They were really knocked back on their heels in a very big way.
Let's play another moment from the film, because it talks about the larger implications of the verdict. We'll hear Floyd Abrams, among others, talking about the significance of this and how troubling a verdict like this could be.
And that's what makes it so dramatic and so disturbing, that the size of the award was essentially a death sentence for this newsroom.
The notion that the publication will cease to exist is something itself extraordinary. And very dangerous. Even if you conclude the worst about Gawker, the idea, first, that they should have lost this case, and second, the idea that they should be gone. The whole situation about this case is extremely problematic.
That was Jay Rosen, we also heard in there. He's also featured in the film. Let's talk about how Peter Thiel now comes into the picture.
Yeah.
Because at first no one knows. I mean, there are – what's great about the film is people are talking about something's happening.
That, right.
I mean, and it wasn't clear though. I mean, someone's spending a lot of money for this and it was pretty shadowy at first.
Yeah, this is a really interesting part of the film because – The story, $140 million was so shocking. It's so out of control that suddenly this kind of, I thought, very nuanced discussion about the First Amendment and privacy concerns and the understanding of Mr. Belay's case and all of that stuff. Suddenly, you know, the axe comes down on Gawker's head and that's it. And that was suddenly questioned what we've been seeing up until this point. And as you're kind of reeling about with that revelation, comes this new revelation that is just absolutely came out of left field, and that is that Silicon Valley billionaire venture capitalist Peter Thiel, early investor of Facebook. Plenty of companies he's contributed to, his money has been in. He's a big figure in Silicon Valley. He was behind it. He was funding Hulk Hogan's lawsuit during this entire period. So suddenly this becomes something wildly different.
Yeah.
It's not just this courtroom drama anymore. Somehow you're just bigger. I mean, we're already dealing with this kind of big issues at stake, and then suddenly everything sort of cracks open here, and we're left to sort of try to understand what these four other forces are that are really behind the scenes.
It's important to note that Peter Thiel has a history, as we'll hear in this clip. We hear David Folkenflik of NPR and David Bixenspan. An independent reporter. He's terrific, by the way.
Yeah.
And he's explaining Thiel's – basically, he has this axe to grind against Nick Denton and Gawker. And we should also explain that ValleyWag, if you don't know, was the Silicon Valley gossip site. It was launched by Gawker Media.
One of the Gawker properties. Yeah.
Right.
He's got a lot of money and a lot of influence. And if he wants it, a pretty big megaphone in Silicon Valley. And he also has a history. He has a history with Gawker itself because ValleyWag went after – his sexual orientation.
Owen Thomas, at this time in charge of ValleyWag, writes an article titled Peter Thiel is Totally Gay, People. From the title, seems like it's probably taking cheap shots. It's not. It's actually a very nuanced article about whether or not Silicon Valley is actually that open-minded.
A story that he very much sought to prevent from being posted and, in fact, essentially threatened Gawker from doing about 8 or 9 years before this lawsuit. Peter Thiel vowed vengeance, and in a state courtroom in Florida, a continent away, Peter Thiel was determined to get it.
Okay, so this raises a bunch of questions. And one of them is, which we'll get to is you have an internet billionaire who has all the money in the world to basically chase down retribution for something. So that's one thing. That's a big theme in the film. But the other thing here, at least momentarily, is the ethical question of outing somebody.
Yeah.
The film is not about that, but it is one of the layers here
to
the story. You want to say something about that?
Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating layer, actually. I think if you talk to most people who are in a kind of more traditional press, outing somebody would be completely and entirely off limits. That would never happen. More aggressive press, I think, would certainly not hesitate to out people if there was some hypocrisy involved, if this was a politician campaigning against gay rights, for instance, and yet they were, secretly – they were in the closet. A lot of people would find that fine. In fact, probably a good thing, an important story. Peter Thiel's not that. Peter Thiel, I never found any evidence that he'd campaigned against anything, any level of hypocrisy on this at all. No, bias against employees or anything.
Right.
So you're confronted with this question about what you know, is that okay or is that not? And I think a lot of people would recoil at the notion. The prevailing wisdom is that that's the person's prerogative.
Right.
That it's their decision what to share about their personal life. But, you know, Nick Denton doesn't believe that. That's just not his position. His position is that why is that something that I need to be ashamed of? Nick Denton, who is also gay,
right,
basically says, look, if you look at the New York Times or a profile in Bloomberg Businessweek of a celebrity or a tech luminary or a business person, the first thing that person, the interviewer, is going to ask is, you know, what about your family and kids and wife, right? But it's off limits somehow if that person is gay. This, I think, from talking and knowing Nick, I think genuinely infuriates him. And I understand that perspective. He says, well, why should we stay away from that? If you're gay, you're gay. And he refuses to say, to think that this is something that should be special or off limits. The article, also, the ValueWag article, Peter Thiel is totally gay, people, is a pretty good indication of or an example of Gawker by itself. The title is so flippant and so snarky and so absurd, right? But the article is about whether or not there's bias in Silicon Valley venture capital and really asks the question, do the largely straight white, you know, male, very small group of people that hand out this enormous sums of money that is sloshing through Silicon Valley, are they basically funding people like themselves? You know what? That's journalism.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It is. And that, I think, is a pretty interesting little example of what Gawker is. Salacious, snarky attitude title, but you know,
but asking the difficult questions.
But that's actually should be asked. Yeah.
Yeah. It also comes out that this isn't the only axe he has to grind.
Yeah.
Peter Thiel against Gawker. There are other things, and this is even more, I think, if you're concerned about free press, even more disturbing, that Gawker had gone after friends of his, had questioned some of his business practices.
Yeah.
So that gets complicated too.
Yeah, I think you can't separate this 9-year tale of revenge and retribution. I mean, first of all,
yeah,
if you're a storyteller, that's just interesting. Who hates somebody for 9 years? This is a calculated. You know, as they say about Dante's in the end of The Count of Monte Cristo, how did I plot my revenge? With pleasure.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think you can separate his anger against Gawker from the many articles that they wrote about his businesses that were critical. And this is, I think, a really interesting point about Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley has so much power and money in our society, and I just don't... They think they're above any sort of critical press, and that's a problem. I mean, that's a problem. These people create the world in which we live, and they should be questioned just like any other powerful people. But they're not used to it.
Yeah,
people in Hollywood are used to it. They got TMZ and the National Enquirer. This is a whole tradition of tabloid culture. Yeah. You know, people in DC, there's a whole press corps. You know, they can always do better. But, you know, there's a group of financial journalists that go after people on Wall Street. I mean, they didn't see the subprime mess happening. You know, they could do better, but at least there's a tradition there. There's no tradition in Silicon Valley of critical press at all. And that's a problem.
And this question of inequality, you've got on one hand a press that's now trying to figure out, the media, how to monetize, the online its coverage, diminishing newsrooms throughout, and then you have this growing money going on. This is a case made by Leslie Seven of the of Nation Magazine. We also hear in this clip Nick Denton and John Cook. He was formerly with Gawker.
Silicon Valley has become a monster of authority and of power in our lives and remains largely invisible.
Silicon Valley billionaires funded by these monopolies now have vastly more power than a fragmented media industry that has lost its most reliable source of revenue, classified ads, has lost that actually to the internet.
We covered Silicon Valley critically, and yes, we were bad for the Valley. Like, yeah. And the reason we were bad for the Valley is because we were telling the truth about the Valley.
You were saying something earlier about
one of the things you were thinking about is a film just about Teal himself. Mm-hmm. And this is the moment in the film when I started thinking, yeah, there's a film about Peter Thiel. Would you just say a little bit about his ideas? He has this seasteading idea. Mm-hmm. He has eccentric political views.
Yeah.
He was a sort of a libertarian, but famously spoke in favor of Donald Trump at the Republican convention. He
right.
has these strange ideas about blood. Has said some odd things about giving women the right to vote as being some kind of a mistake for democracy or whatever. He's a really fascinating, eccentric guy.
He is, indeed. And he said a lot of things that I think are highly controversial at best, is the best way to put it. I mean, look, he wrote a book called The Diversity Myth, in which he said some very provocative things. I mean, he did write that it is historically difficult for a libertarian that women's right to vote was historically difficult for libertarians. I mean, you know, he has some very controversial views, to say the least. Yeah, you mentioned seasteading, things like that. He is a part of a group called the Seasteading Institute,
yep.
which is essentially building these kind of islands off the coast away from international laws where presumably a new libertarian utopia could be built. I don't know what the role of a free press in that scenario would be, but it's interesting. I mean, certainly,
but it does
I think
get
by
to the,
itself.
I was going to say it does get to a point that he makes, which is that he thinks this is a him funding this case
yeah.
was philanthropy. That's how he saw it.
That's how he sees it, yeah. Look, he hated Gawker. I mean, he really hated Gawker.
Yeah.
Some for good reason. But, I mean, one of the things that he said when asked about this at the National Press Club was that they were a singularly sociopathic bully. And, I mean, I think that makes no sense, especially in a world in which we have – you know, lots of toxic, you know, false stories running through the veins of Facebook. You know, one of the most popular shared stories on the run-up to the election was a story about how Hillary Clinton and John Podesta ran a child sex trafficking ring out of a pizza joint. Or how Donald Trump was, you know, was endorsed by the Pope. You know, this is... you know, it's hard to look at any Gawker story in the millions of articles and say, well, that wasn't actually true, that they didn't retract. Well, Facebook is coursing. Its veins are coursing with this toxic sludge. And so I think that this idea that somehow Gawker was a singularly sociopathic bully is absurd. But that's what he thought and that's what he believed. I mean, look, I don't have a problem believing that that he had a legitimate gripe against Gawker, or that there isn't a reason for that hatred. I take him at face value there. But they're certainly not a singularly sociopathic bully.
It's Brian Knappenberger. His film is called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. It premiered at Sundance this year. It's just been released on Netflix. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with filmmaker Brian Knappenberger. We're talking about his film, Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. All right, let's talk about another layer. I mean, there are a lot of layers here. And another one that emerges, plays out in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Las Vegas Review Journal. Tell us about, just set this up for us. And mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about this because this is another really interesting part of the story.
Yeah, so the Las Vegas Review-Journal, you know, last year a lot of things were afoot that seemed new when it came to this sort of the threats on the press, and one of them that seemed to dovetail closely with the Hulk Hogan story were the events of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. What happened was that the writers, and we hear this from the perspective of the writers,
yeah.
they were told that the paper was sold. And then they were told.
They had no idea.
They had no idea.
This was a great part. They went to this meeting and they were just told, you've been sold.
Right. And they're shocked. I mean, you can imagine if any company you work for is suddenly sold. You know, that's a big deal. It's a change of the guard. And so legitimately, they asked, well, who is it? And what they were told then was, you know what? Don't worry about it. The owners of the paper, they don't want you to know. Just do your jobs and don't worry about who bought the pit. It's not that big a deal, whatever. And the reporter said, well, wait a minute. What is our job?
Yeah.
This is the biggest story. I mean, look, the Las Vegas Review-Journal, if you don't live in the West somewhere, you may not know. Like, it's actually an important paper, and particularly as Nevada has become a more important state politically, you know, Las Vegas Review-Journal is important to a lot of people, and it's a big newspaper. It's got a big reach. So the idea that they wouldn't know who bought the paper and what that person's interests would be was just
crazy.
I think it was infuriating for them.
It just seems so naive that you say, look, the paper's been purchased. Don't ask who bought it.
Yeah.
To a bunch of reporters.
To reporters. I mean, it's comically absurd.
It's comically absurd.
It's throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah. And they took it up, the gauntlet. Talk about that part, because this is an important part of the story. They're going to find out.
I think not for 30 seconds did they take that seriously. And I know that they just huddled after that meeting. They instantly huddled and said, whatever happens, including, by the way, potential loss of our own jobs, we gotta figure this out. And so we go on this mission with them to uncover who bought their paper.
Do you want to talk about who it was?
Yeah, so it ended up being the casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, owner of Venetian, among other properties, one of the richest men in the world.
And who spends a lot of money on supporting Republican political candidates as well.
Yeah, so and that's a big part of the political cycle is candidates coming to talk with Sheldon to get some money.
So they uncover this and they write the story. There are a number of reporters that you talk to, former, I guess we should say now, reporters for the paper, Mike Hengel, James Wright, Jennifer Robeson. We'll hear all of them in this moment when they get the story ready and they're waiting for clearance to publish it.
Yeah.
But they get no answer. Right. The day sort of plays out. And here you'll hear sort of what happens.
I knew it was probably a career ending decision. I was standing right there when I did it. I mean, I had my computer out. I was going back and forth with the newsroom. You know, it was 7 o'clock and I'm just waiting for something, either a yes, a no, a maybe, and it never came. So I just said, okay, we need to go with this and let the chips fall.
He said, well, I can't say what he said.
It started with an F and ended with the word it.
It was scary. It was scary, but it's what you have to do. It really is. I mean, some stories are worth losing your job over.
I really liked this part of the film.
It's a moving moment. It really is. Think of all the forces at work there. I mean, you know, these are reporters. Their job is to figure out the story, find it out, get scoops, you know, and they had one and they weren't allowed to tell the world about it. It sort of strikes right at the heart of anybody who's inclined to do that job. That's why they do it.
Yeah.
And they did it and they figured it out and they never got the okay to hit go. And so here's a group of people that said, look, we don't care what this means. This is more important even than our jobs.
Yeah.
And they did it anyway.
And what's relevant for the story here, of course, is the fact that Sheldon Adelson essentially bought the paper, or you could imply that he bought the paper because the paper had not been entirely favorable to him in their coverage. And in particular, one remarkable Here's another character, a remarkable man by the name of John A. Smith, a columnist, who wrote a book and had written various pieces in the paper critical of Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah.
Talk about this part of the story. This is really
One of the star columnists of the Las Vegas Review Journal is John L. Smith, if you want a story about what journalism could and should be, I mean, he's pretty much it. It's he wrote it wasn't an article for the Review Journal; it was a book
right?
about Las Vegas. It was called "Sharks in the Desert," and he was talking about the history of Las Vegas, and you believe that there is. You don't write a history without at least including a chapter on Sheldon Adelson. So Sheldon Adelson took some issue with something that he wrote and leveled a multi-million dollar lawsuit against him, this writer. We sort of tell the personal story. John L. Smith was in the hospital with his daughter who had just gotten brain cancer when this happened. So he goes through this period of time in which he's incredibly, incredibly – you know, it's very, very difficult for him, and which he's trying to deal with his lawsuit and this problems and medical problems that his daughter is going through, and so he chooses to sort of fight it and sort of keep going. It's a very, very intense period of time for him, and there's one point in the film in which Adelson, in the story, in which Adelson actually reaches out through an intermediary and says, "Look, we will pay for some of your daughter's expenses if you say that you libeled me."
Yeah.
And John Smith says no.
And he needed it.
Yeah.
That's another thing that's remarkable about it. I mean, this intermediary was a rabbi. He reaches out to Smith and tries to get him to just admit that you libeled me.
Yeah.
And I'll pay your daughter's medical bills. And he doesn't.
It's an extraordinary story about someone who's got a lot of money who can leverage these things.
Yeah.
And
And Folk and Flick of NPR was really moved by this story. Talks about the heroism of John Smith going forward. And you have to talk about Jennifer Robeson and Mike Hengel, their willingness to go forward with the story even though they knew it was going to jeopardize their careers.
Yeah.
It's interesting. John Smith says in the film that a free and independent press isn't a guarantee, it's a goal.
Yeah. I think that's true. It's never something that you can't fight for. And I think that's part of what this film shows. I mean, it's corroding around the edges. There's always efforts to kind of stop it or shut it up or silence it. But really the First Amendment and the free press that it guarantees is a critical part of who we are and how we make decisions. I mean, you don't exist in a participatory democracy without knowing what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, we should presumably understand, you know, learn as much as we can about what's happening before we make decisions about who will govern us.
Let me ask you this finally. How are you assessing the aftermath of Donald Trump as president? Floyd Abrams mentions, and this question comes up in the film, it's hard to predict how much Donald Trump is going to be prepared to implement any of the threats he made on the campaign trail related to the press, wanting to sort of ramp up libel laws, those kinds of things. What's your final impression, do you think, of what's about to happen?
Well, we've seen candidate Trump behave as an authoritarian, essentially, and we've seen his rise be largely the result of an all-out assault on the press. He berates them, calls them names, has blacklisted them from going to his various rallies and speeches. He's ridiculed them. Several members have felt like they were physically threatened. There was many news organizations have had to beef up their security. Because after things like satire, Saturday Night Live, which actually may be one of our best weapons at the moment. Satire is pretty powerful. Look, I think we got a lot to be concerned about, but how do you move forward into this new world with this guy? I think, I mean, for me, it's two things. It's
It's calling out his lies. You know, it's continuing to speak truth to power. It's calling out every instance of kleptocratic greed any time that there's any kind of restriction on any sort of civil liberties. I mean, it's like that guy, John Acosta, who was harassing him at that from CNN, who was harassing him at that. We should all be that guy every day for the entire administration, for the entire time that he's our president. But I actually think it's got to be way more than that. I mean, there's a certain part of it is like we have to forget about Trump a little bit and define what is the way forward. Mm. And I think as a documentary filmmaker, you got to think, well, what kind of world do we want? What kind of stories should we tell? Donald Trump is telling a story about this country. It's not the story I think this country is. So it's our job as storytellers and journalists and writers to steal back the narrative, take it back from him. That's not who we are. So I think that there's a part where we need to speak truth to power, hold him accountable, and do all of the things that journalism is supposed to do. But we also have to understand that both parties have failed here and that we need to define for ourselves, and maybe this is the silver lining in what's happening, what can we do? What country can we be if we want it?
Brian Knappenberger. His documentary film is called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. It premiered at Sundance this year and has now been released on Netflix. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.